passage today is from the text of Luke 21, verses 1 through 4. Now he looked up and saw the wealthy putting their gifts into the temple treasury, and he saw a poor widow putting in 2 lepta coins. And he said, "Truly, I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all of them, for they all contributed in the offering from their surplus, but she, from her poverty, put in all that she had to live on."
Thank you, Alice. You know, we in the 21st century, we kind of think it's archaic to have somebody stand with a Bible and read the text. But it's actually a very sacred thing. You know, for thousands of years, Christians, the only way they got the Word of God was to listen to it be read, because most of them couldn't read. And so someone who could read would stand, and at times there would be hundreds, even thousands of people, even in the streets, just standing and listening, because that's the only way they could get it. So I never take it lightly when that happens, when someone's willing to stand up and publicly read the scriptures. It's a wonderful thing. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Jeff Hill, and I substitute here once in a while when Pastor Jeff is swamped, and he's away at a conference this last week, so I'm up. A number of years ago, my wife and I were invited to a fundraising banquet for Teen Challenge, and we were guests at a table sponsored by a young man from our Bible study group at the time. Let's call him Brad. And Brad had been a former resident of Teen Challenge, and it was there that he encountered Christ, was set free, and started living a new life. And Brad had only been walking in this new path for a few months, and as you might expect, starting life anew after years of drug and alcohol addiction doesn't bring instant financial stability. So for Brad, to sponsor a table at this event was an enormous step of faith. But his gratitude was enormous as well. And of the hundreds of people at this event, only the few of us at our table knew Brad was our sponsor and knew of the sacrifice it took for him to do such a thing. In contrast to that, later in the evening, amid no small amount of fanfare, there was a bit of a ceremony where a well-known local businessman presented a check to Teen Challenge for $30,000. You know, one of those 2.5 by 6 foot checks with his signature prominently displayed in oohs and ahs and applause all around. I was convinced that if he didn't need his arms to hold up that cardboard check, he would have patted himself on the back. And this man had a reputation for being a successful Christian businessman. He was touted in the local media for being a true, selfless philanthropist. I knew who he was. Everyone in the banquet hall knew who he was. Everyone in the metro knew who he was. However, that evening on the way home, I was expressing to my wife my surprise, and probably in a snarky bit, my commentaries, that a Christian man would want his contributions to be so public. I did then and do now have a certain reverence for quiet, anonymous giving. Jesus spoke to that in Matthew 6. He said, "Let your giving be in secret." I have to admit, I was a bit put off by the whole display. And whenever I read the story of the widow and her last penny, the lepta coin that we saw, I know most of us don't have any idea what a lepta coin is. Every culture has a coin that's worth the smallest amount in their culture. For us, it's a penny. For the ancient Hebrews, it was the lepta. But whenever I read that story, I'm reminded of that banquet evening. You see, Brad went on to work as a machinist, where he became a faithful, productive employee. The big man, the noisy giver, he's serving a 50-year sentence at Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. He was convicted of running the biggest Ponzi scheme in Minnesota history. Many organizations, schools, and ministries had to return millions to creditors that they had received, money they had received in good faith. In fact, as a result of the fiasco, Teen Challenge had to lay off 22 employees. Evidently, not all giving is gold. And I'm sure all of my fellow gray hairs here this morning, if I mention that man's name, you'd know who he was. So we're going to, as we look at this text today, we're going to look at three main characters, and maybe we'll be able to see why the Teen Challenge banquet story comes to my mind. We're going to look at the rich, the widow, and the Lord. First, let's look at the rich. It says that they were putting their gifts in the treasury. Now, the setup of the treasury itself is very germane to our story. The treasury consisted of two covered walkways on either side of a large courtyard in the temple complex. And in these walkways were large bell-shaped receptacles. Think about the bell part of a tuba. And that had emptied in to a large box. And when a person deposited their offering into the opening, the larger the amount, the more noise it would make. And when the box was full, the temple officers would drag it away and replace it with an empty. Often, the rich would make sure their gifts made a great deal of clanging as their coins tumbled down the brass portal. In fact, the late biblical scholar and expositor Ray Stedman points out that some of the wealthier lawyers and Pharisees used to hire trumpet players to walk before them on their way to the treasury, blowing loudly, announcing that a great contribution was about to be made. And sometimes they would make arrangements ahead of time with the temple officers to have the box dragged away immediately following their deposit, implying that their gift was so large that the box was now full. Now we have to ask, why the display? Why the spectacle? I'd like to suggest a couple of reasons. First, just the general symptom of fallen man desperately seeking for identity and seeking to be right with God through their own actions. Look at me, look at me. I'm something. Even God notices me. People want to be noticed. I'm sure all of us can point to stupid things we've done or said just so we'd be noticed. And when we think on those times, I don't think we're real proud of those moments. At least I'm not. And second, the second reason I think that there was a display and a spectacle has to do with the cultural norms of the time. Embedded in the ancient Hebrew culture, identity, and even in their theology, was the idea that wealth was a sure sign God was on your side and you were on his. And we can't be too hard on the ancient Hebrews for thinking this way. After all, the patriarchs, the founders of their nation, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they were wealthy men. Abraham was so wealthy he had his own private militia. And their heroes, David and Solomon, were wealthy. Solomon's wealth was almost impossible to measure. Then in the Proverbs and the Psalms, there are multiple, if you do this, then this will happen writings where wealth and prosperity are linked with obeying God's commands. Think about the disciples' response when Jesus told them it was easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. They were shocked. Well, then who can be saved? They asked. Wealth equals right. It was an idea Jesus was trying to turn on its head for his followers. Wealth was not to be considered a guaranteed, generic description of the godly. And in the Gospels, when we see Jesus interacting with the rich and talking about the rich, there are two types. There are two connotations to the word. There are those who are honest, who do good with their wealth, who truly are blessed by God. He's not opposed to them, and he's not opposed to wealth in and of itself. And then there are those who are rich because of the abuse of the poor, rich by taking advantage of others, rich from corruption and theft. Jesus did not support that type of rich. In fact, he had some woe to you type statements for those folks. Context always helps us see which rich is which. So we have a scene here with many observers in the courtyard, and people are placing their gifts in the treasury, and many of them, for sure the rich, want the contribution noticed. Then the observers, by implication, are watching to see who are the haves and who are the have-nots, and forming opinions. And the temple officers, they're watching as well. They're taking note of who should be given preference and respect, and maybe they're even trying to figure out who they should try to get close to. And then we come to the widow. The very fact there is a penniless widow in Israel is a dark mark on the nation. A penniless widow is the ultimate symbol of ancient Israel's rebellion and rejection of their God. A penniless widow is a glaring proof of the religious leader's callous attitude and total lack of concern for the less fortunate. You see, when God first introduced himself to Israel by delivering them from centuries of slavery in Egypt, he gave them laws of life to live by. And one of the primary instructions was to protect and care for the orphan and the widow. And if they were to oppress the orphan and the widow, it would kindle his great anger. He did not mince words about this. In Exodus 22, God tells them, "If you afflict the widow, I will end you." He's serious. Later on in their history, when they were in decline as a nation, he sent prophets to warn them that they were going to be destroyed as a nation and carried away to a foreign land. And one of the major reasons he gave for this affliction that was about to come upon them was because they oppressed the widows and orphans. And then after they had been exiled and were complaining against God and mourning their situation, he sent other prophets telling them the reason they were in this predicament was because they afflicted their widows. Just last week, Pastor Jeff covered the scene where the professional class, the Sadducees, the scribes, and the lawyers were trying to publicly humiliate the country bumpkin preacher with questions they assumed had no answer. However, when his answer shut them up, Jesus went one step further and he pronounced judgment on them. He listed six things they practiced that proved they were totally out of step with God. And one of those indictments was that they devoured widows' houses. It's the very last verse of the previous chapter. You know, we have chapter divisions, unfortunately, in our Bible, and little numbers by each verse. They didn't have that originally. So right after Jesus is telling them that they've devoured widows' houses, we go right into a scene with a widow. No break. Again, to understand this idea of devouring widows' houses, we have to take a glimpse of a culture that existed over 2,000 years ago. We always have to remember when we look at the gospel stories that we're not looking at 21st century America. That is not our lens. So back then, if a man had an estate, it was common practice to appoint a lawyer to manage his estate and care for his wife in the event of his death. Now, if the lawyer was an honest man, he would use the assets of the estate to make sure that the widow of his friend was properly cared for. If, however, he was a dishonest man, he would manipulate the assets into his possession and literally devour the widow's house. Women had no legal standing. They had no recourse in the courts. So if the man her husband appointed was a crook, she would shortly become penniless. And Jesus' words to those who practice such things? You will receive greater condemnation. And the ancient Hebrew culture had also deteriorated to the point where the commonly held thought was that if you were destitute, physically or financially, it's your own fault. You are somehow under God's judgment. This idea was so ingrained in the collective mindset that it hadn't even been erased yet from the worldview of Jesus' disciples, even after they'd been with him for a while. In John 9, we have a scene where the group comes upon a blind man, and the disciples are wondering how come this guy is blind, and so they ask Jesus, who sinned? His parents or him, that he should be blind? It becomes easier to ignore the plight of the destitute, the afflicted, and the infirmed when we hold the belief that their predicament is either a result of their own individual shortcomings or that they are under God's judgment. Can you imagine a culture where the rich and the corrupt are celebrities and the poor and the hopeless are receiving their just deserts? What did Solomon write? There is nothing new under the sun. But what did Jesus say about that? He said, what you do to the least, you do to me. And now the individual widow herself, where'd she come from? Was she a resident of Jerusalem? Maybe. But remember our setting. This is the most high holy week on the calendar. People are coming from all over the country. Jerusalem can't hold the crowds. So when the Passover was happening, an entire world of tent cities would pop up in the hillsides outside the walls. Thousands and thousands of people descending upon the city, and somewhere in the midst of all that noise and clamor, there she is, alone. And how did she get to the treasury? Either from the other side of town or from town miles away, however or wherever she walked, a solitary soul moving through the throng. And even though she only had a penny to her name, even though the people who were supposed to care for her wouldn't, even though the temple system was corrupt, even though it would be a long trek, and even though observers would see her pitiful little gift and pass judgment, maybe even causing embarrassment, despite all that, somewhere at some time, she decided she wanted to give her coin to God. And although the economic system she lived in was against her, and although the culture she lived in abandoned her, and although she had no guarantee of her next meal, she did not succumb to the thought that God was against her. She didn't blame God either. Carrying that coin to the temple was an act of worship. It was an act of faith. It was a personal transaction between her and God, truly the perfect and most pure example of giving. And if she wanted to give her coin to God, there was only one place it could be done, the temple, the treasury. She didn't have 20-some charities to choose from. She couldn't mail it in. There was no online giving platform, and there was no black box at the back of the sanctuary to drop an envelope into. If she wanted to give her coin to God, she had to do it at the temple. Can you see her? Quietly moving through the crowded courtyard, getting in line, sandwiched between people wearing jewelry and flowing, colorful robes, holding the sum total of all her money in her palm. Then the man in front of her drops his gift into the opening, and there's loud banging, and his coins and gold crash against the brass. She steps forward. It's her turn. She deposits her coin. There's a trickle of a sound. And the temple officer, the one who should be pulling money out of the chest and giving it to her, instead gives her a disapproving glance. Can you see her? She lowers her head, hopes not too many people noticed her, slips through the crowd, and walks back to her anonymous existence. Unaware that, unaware that a certain someone did notice her. Someone with an all-knowing and compassionate eye, Jesus. In our passage here, it says Jesus looked up to see what was happening. In the parallel passage in the Gospel of Mark, it says he sat down to observe. The first thing we notice about Jesus is that he observes, he watches, he sees, he knows. The writer of Hebrews tells us in chapter 4, no creature is hidden from his sight, but all things are open and laid bare to the eyes of him with whom we have to deal with. He's not oblivious to what's going on. He sees the corruption of the temple system. He sees the pretension. He sees the false motives of many. But he also sees the humble and sincere. Because just as our gospel writers have two connotations for the rich, they also have two connotations for the poor. There are those who simply have nothing and live in desperation, living a life either blaming God or ignoring him. And then there are those who are poor and depend on God. And we're told here we have a poor widow. Again, context tells us which poor is which. Then our text in Luke 21 simply says, he said. He said. But once again, if we lean into Mark 12, we find he calls his disciples over to himself and he does the truly I say to you teaching with them. Allow me to paraphrase. Excuse me. Here he is, judging. And after he observes, he judges, and he passes judgment, and he lets his followers know what the judgment is. Allow me to paraphrase. Boys, you see that poor woman there walking away who just dropped a penny in the pot? She put in more than all those big noisemakers. And my friends, Jesus judges correctly. Is there anyone here who doubts the precision in his assessment? Anyone doubt his distinction between the poor widow and the big noisy givers? No, we know he judges correctly. And what's the great proclamation of Psalm 19? The judgments of the Lord are true. They are completely righteous. He is aware of the amounts given. He keeps track of amounts. He not only is aware of what is given, he is aware of what is kept. But what he is teaching his disciples is that his ledger is not like the ledger of the temple officers. It is not the ledger in the imagination of the rich. His ledger is not the ledger in the minds of the opinion-forming crowd. Amounts that get placed on the asset side of his ledger are placed there when they are given with sincere hearts, with an exercise of faith and with a posture of worship. One more thought on the observations and judgments of Jesus. I think at times we operate under the misconception that we have to do big things for God. We operate under the misconception at times that we have to do something great in order for God to notice or for God to get involved. Please observe. Please take note. The person who gave the least, so to speak, the person who by most measurements did an extremely tiny thing, the person whose contribution to God, it would be impossible to even find it in the treasury box. That person, in the eyes of God, she won the day. Our God is a God who can use small things to accomplish that which is beyond our imagination. What did he do with Moses' stick, his staff? He rained plagues down in Egypt and parted the Red Sea. What did he do with a small stone in the hand of David? Down went the giant and a nation was born. How about when Jesus was standing in front of thousands and thousands and he wanted to feed them and they didn't have a clue what to do, and one of his disciples brings this little boy up to him and he says, "Oh, we have a lad here with two fish and a few loaves." I'm aware of a couple of ladies in one small congregation in the Congo who started feeding some local children who were orphaned by AIDS. Just a few children, just a few ladies. Now, some 15 years later, there are over 6,000 children in 12 different countries who are fed and cared for. But it started with a simple concern, their willingness to feed just a few. Their small act of service. And what did the prophet Zechariah say? Who dares despise small beginnings? And what about the church? The millions and millions of current believers and millions of believers from the past. An enormous crowd. All from the seed of one solitary man planted in the ground and sprouting forth. If you are someone who is doing something for the Lord and it seems small and insignificant, please take note. Please be encouraged. He sees you. It's not insignificant to him. And he is more than able to use it for his glory. Heavenly Father, we acknowledge you are the one who sees all and knows all. Please draw us closer to yourself and allow us to see the people around us as you see them. Amen. Thank you.